certain vessels that needed to, that we needed to do some work related to our initiatives. They indicated that they would be cooperative with us, and in some ways they were able to help. But in many ways, this lack of certain vessels that needed to, that we needed to do some work related to our initiatives, they indicated that they would be cooperative with us, and in some ways they were able to help. But in many ways, this lack of organization, this lack of thinking big enough to get around this problem, hampered them in getting that job done, in my view. In part because, suppose we had an agreement that on Tuesday morning... Sure. Thank you. So suppose we had an agreement that on Tuesday morning, Exxon would have a barge and a skimmer to support the operation that we were doing from the State Ferry Aurora. Well, that indicated a willingness to cooperate, it seemed to us. But if on Tuesday morning the barge wasn't operational because it didn't have a pump, and the skimmer was off somewhere else because there hadn't been adequate radio contact to get him there, the result was just the same. And that was the kind of thing that, that frustrated us. The same problem was reported to me by officials of local communities, where they felt as if the local Exxon representative understood their problem and was trying to get them boom or trying to help them get an area cleaned up, but that they couldn't get the authorization out of the bureaucracy that Exxon had set up here in Valdez, so that you ended up with basically broken communication links or no communication links that hampered the whole thing, and the result was just chaotic rather than responsive. Maybe I could ask Mr. Chairman if Larry Dietrich has any different characterization of that. He was close to many parts of this during the first 3 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I think that you have to recognize that was going on here is the mobilization effort that was simultaneously going on to get additional resources, equipment, hardware, get it out into the field, overcoming this really severe logistical problems of deploying this, and the initial communications problems. Communications out in the Sound are extremely difficult, and those things combined together indicate unpreparedness and an inability to effectively respond. All of those things added up.
Thank you. I'll pass the time being.
That was Representative Owen from Utah.
So,
Representative DeFazio from Oregon.
To a couple of things where we have had that contradictory information that I referred to, particularly dispersants and burning. We've heard that basically it's the fault of the state of Alaska or the Coast Guard. The dispersants were not used, and the dispersants could have resolved or significantly mitigated the problem at the beginning of this spill. Would you care to address that? You mentioned the zone system. As my understanding is, in certain zones, there's basically pre-approval given. Other zones require some sort of concurrent or subsequent approval to use dispersants. And could you address the efforts of dispersants that were used, your observations of the effectiveness of that, and at what point did you become a roadblock to the use of dispersants, if ever?
Well, let me answer the last part of that first. At no point was the state of Alaska a roadblock to the use of dispersants, in certainly not in the pre-approved area. And we even approved the use of dispersants in a Zone 3 area, which is the most sensitive, potentially the most sensitive biologically. We authorized that use. And the only thing that prevented us from continuing to authorize Zone 3 use is that they couldn't seem to keep the dispersant in the areas where it was approved for use. It was at that point that they did a dispersant dump that hit the tanker and Coast Guard employees. But let me go back to the first part. I think the part of this that is most misleading is the suggestion that Exxon could have controlled this spill through the use of dispersants. They simply didn't have either equipment or dispersant available to do that job. And they didn't have equipment to do the mechanical work either. So this idea that somebody else prevented them from doing something that they didn't have the capacity to do in the first place seems to me it has to be kept in perspective. But let me, with your permission, talk about how the approvals go. The Coast Guard has the ultimate authority to authorize use of chemical dispersants, and they consider those through the regional response team on which we sit as a member. The regional response team approved the use of dispersants many months now before this spill in other Zone 1 areas. And Zone 1 is just a label to describe the areas where dispersants are least likely to have an adverse effect on biological organisms or a sensitive environment. It's important to bear in mind that dispersants don't take any oil out of the water. They break it up into small particles and they distribute it more deeply in the water column so that there are some instances under which it's a good tool to use. And our approach has been that dispersants are an appropriate tool under some circumstances, but you should use it on a case-by-case basis. If you can't be successful with mechanical means, then take a look at whether dispersants are going to have an adverse effect. If they aren't, it's a tool that certainly should be kept in the kit. The RRT had approved the use of dispersants in Zone 1 areas outside of Prince William Sound. They'd indicated that they were favorable to the use of dispersants in Prince William Sound, and on March 7th and 8th of this year, they approved their use in Prince William Sound. So for our purposes, there was no need for anyone to ask us for further authority in Zone 1. And Zone 1 is a large area in the center of Prince William Sound on each side of the tanker lanes, and for most of the first few days, that slick had moved into the Zone 1 area. The Coast Guard, and I wouldn't propose to speak for them, but this is my understanding of how it went. The Coast Guard normally likes to know whether the use of dispersants in any particular instance makes sense. And in this instance, they knew that the water was calm, the wind was very light, so the high energy that is normally needed in the sea in order to have dispersants be effective, basically to mix the dispersants with the oil, were not present. The Coast Guard then asked for some trial applications to see whether this stuff worked. And those initial applications on Saturday and Sunday just didn't do the job. In fact, I believe that even Mr. Irasi from Exxon indicated that the tests observed on Saturday were, quote, marginal, close quote. So the problem was basically they didn't have the equipment, and according to the information they provided at the time, they also didn't have enough dispersant on hand, and had they had both of those, they didn't have the conditions suitable for the use of that. At no time did we withdraw our approval, and at the time when the Coast Guard concluded that a trial had been sufficiently successful, the Coast Guard went ahead and authorized it. But even after that authorization, there was still a delay, and that was not attributable to either the Coast Guard or the state. Part of that was due to wind conditions that came up, prevented aircraft from operating for a while. But even after that wind died down, Exxon still was not ready to deliver the dispersal drop because the aircraft hadn't been loaded in Anchorage. So this idea that somehow the government had blocked them from doing an effective response is just totally off base. Even the numbers that they're talking about now require you to toss aside, for example, Mr. Rawl suggested that the amount of dispersant that could be used here was actually much less than what they had indicated previously. They'd indicated that a 20-to-1 ratio was necessary. The suggestion that he made was that you use something in excess of 200-to-1, 200 parts oil to one part dispersant. Well, that's contrary to the scientific information, the technical data about how these substances really work. So when you take all of those factors into consideration, I don't see how a reasonable person can conclude that Exxon had the capacity to do what the chairman now wishes to persuade people it would have done if only someone else hadn't blocked them from doing it. And, of course, the state was not blocking them from applying that dispersant had they been able to do so.
Okay, well, we've also heard that it could have been burned, and that because of objections by a small village and by environmental groups, objections on air quality, that the state, after a successful test burn, because of the smoke problems, prohibited further burning. Could you address that, please?
Let me address the first part, and then quickly, and then I'll ask Larry. The state approved a burning permit, and there was an initial burn that was done. It successfully ignited and maintained a burn that the contractor reported. I was present in the meeting with Admiral Nelson and Commander McCall when results of that test burn were discussed. And what was discussed was approximately 15,000 to 30,000 barrels, perhaps toward the lower end of that, had been successfully ignited. Gallons, not barrels. So in that 15,000 to 30,000 gallon range, which would have been about 0.15, a little less than 0.15% of the spill, the permit was still good. And so they then tried to initiate a sustained burn, which was unsuccessful. And the burn failed not because of the lack of permission to go forward. It failed because of the physical limitations on maintaining that burn in the spill as it existed at that time.
Never prohibited further burning nor delayed further burning.
Eventually that permit expired, and I don't know whether it was ever requested for there to be additional burning.
Well, eventually, at what point is eventually? After we experienced the high winds and the consistency of the slick changed, or prior to that occurrence?
Do you remember when that was?
I think it was about the third day when they had planned. There were burn tests planned for the day following the winds that had occurred on those leading edges, and it was getting at about that time frame when getting the material to burn was becoming no longer successful.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, do I still have some time? I was going to ask the other witness a couple questions. Okay. I'd like to ask Mr. Rue a couple questions. Just, again, contradictory information receiving. Numbers of dead and dying birds, sea otters and others. You have numbers here, quoted on page 2. As of May 3rd, 9,000 dead birds, 640 dead sea otters. First of all, just please tell us on what you base that. And secondly, if you could extrapolate from that, if we found that many, how many more might there have been? I know, again, that's perhaps difficult to do, but I would, given the magnitude of the area that's covered here, the nature of some of these, the particularly the diving birds and that, I assume that this isn't all. This is so-called tip of the iceberg.
Yes, Mr. Fazio, thank you. The 9,000 and the 640 are, as I understand it, the numbers that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been recording that have been turned into the various Seward, Valdez, Kodiak, Kenai, Homer centers. The estimates of how many more there are very difficult. Some people have guessed at 10 times this number, but as you all have seen in flying around this country, it's big. There aren't many people out there walking the beaches. There are a few cleanup crews. There's some cleanup crews now, but if you look at the outer coast of the Kenai and now the Alaska Peninsula and Kodiak, it is very remote country. The possibility of finding the birds is very low. So one estimate is that we find maybe 1 in 10. It could be much higher than that.
So 1 in 10 at this point in time, that would be 90,000.
Yeah, we don't know.
Okay. Finally, the page 3, you have 400 miles of shoreline and intertidal habitat as having been oiled. And this is as of, I assume, back again on the May 3rd date. We had a briefing from Exxon yesterday, which was 365. Could you address where did you get the 400? What's the date of that?
The 400 miles, I believe, came from information that DEC was providing. I might ask that Claudia Slater of my staff come up, and I believe she was the one who collected the information. She might be able to help. spot here.
I swear you, for this purposes, and repeat again, it is the practice of the subcommittee to swear all witnesses who appear before it as investigative hearings. Do you have any objections to being sworn?
No, I do not.
Here, please. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
In order to inform you of your rights as a witness before the committee and limitations on the authority of the subcommittee, the rules of the House of Representatives and the committee are on the table in front of you. Both sets of rules have previously been provided to you. You are advised of your right to counsel. The role of counsel would be to advise you of your constitutional rights. Do you desire to be represented by counsel? Mr. Fazio.
Would you please address the estimate of the number of miles of shoreline intertidal habitat that has been oiled, the date of that estimate, where you got that estimate, and if you could perhaps project into what the daily accretion is now, if you have that information also.
That figure was derived from DEC shoreline estimates on Wednesday of last week. And I don't know how much they have documented since that time or if they have an estimate of the rate of continuing contamination along the shoreline.
400 miles as of last Wednesday.
Yes, sir.
Sounds true.
Chairman, I might point out that is a dynamic number, and when I left the office to come over here, our crew was updating that on an island-by-island basis, so the figure that we have in the next couple of days should be much more accurate. But I would expect it to be a larger number rather than a smaller number.
Sure. If you could, it would be excellent if you could provide that prior to the commencement of the hearing tomorrow, at least some preliminary update, even if it's not all the total mileage, that would be very useful.
Commissioner Kelso, I'd like to return to, I guess, what is a critical 72-hour period immediately after the Exxon Valdez ran aground. From what I can gather, your department had received representations from Alyeska that they had the capacity to recover 100,000 barrels of crude oil within the first 48 hours after such an oil spill. Is that correct?
That's my understanding.
And that was in the contingency plan which was provided to your department?
Or is that actually in the plan?
I don't know. I'm not sure that the 100,000 barrel figure is actually in the plan. I think that at least has been an item of discussion over the years in the development of the plan is the rate and amount that can be picked up and in what time frame.
Is it true that representations were made to your department, if not within the contingency plan, at least in correspondence between Alyeska and your department, that there would be the capacity to recover this amount of oil?
That's correct.
All right. Now, I think this is critical to our discussion here, because if the information which we've been given is accurate, had that occurred, we would be facing a much different set of circumstances today. Would you agree?
I would agree.
I also recall that there were some assumptions or premises to their recovering this amount of oil in terms of the weather conditions, current conditions, and that sort of thing. Is that not correct?
Yes.
At the time of this incident, were those conditions all met?
Again, ask Larry for help in terms of remembering the specific conditions that are described, the assumption that in the contingency plan, but I think your point is that the condition, the weather conditions, the sea state was very favorable to the recovery of oil from the surface. And so the likelihood of being able to respond should have been quite good in light of the assurances in the contingency plan.
From the information we've been given you by your department, the dramatic change in weather conditions around a period of 60 to 72 hours caused a great expansion of this oil slick. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
In fact, if the information we have is accurate, the oil slick, both heavy and moderate, grew from an area of about 97 square miles some 60 hours after the incident, and then within 72 hours after that, it was over 528 square miles. So had there been an early response, as Alyeska had indicated, it would have obviously reduced the exposure of all of the communities and islands and beaches and waterfowl and fish affected by this. Is that not correct?
That's right.
Questioning by Richard Durbin of Illinois.
We had the opportunity to visit Alyeska today. It is probably as modern and update a facility as anyone could ever visit, with great technical capacity, great science and technology being put to work there. How do you explain then that after such representations are made to you and the people of Alaska concerning their capacity to respond to an oil spill, that apparently little or nothing was done?
Since I can't look into motivation, I don't have that crystal ball. All I can go on is what I see in the way of a pattern of behavior and of the actual response in this instance. And the pattern was one of minimizing environmental controls, whether we're talking about oil spill response or water pollution or air pollution. The pattern has been the same. I would guess that that had to do with a lack of serious belief that this kind of event could occur.
And yet your department had asked Alyeska to provide a contingency plan for just this sort of occurrence.
That's correct.
So as unlikely as it might have been, they were asked to consider what they would do if the facts presented themselves. So it came as no great surprise to them when in fact the situation presented itself.
It should not have come as a surprise.
One of the things that I've also found interesting in my visit to Alaska is the discussion of evaporation and biodegradation of this oil spill. One could conclude after listening to several people that if we leave this alone, eventually it will all go away. I ran into a worker out on Smith Island yesterday, and I want to join your earlier comments that many of the people, not only those who are on the islands working to clean up this mess, but also the men and women in uniform, I might add, who are doing a great duty, great service to this country, are working long and hard hours. One of the workers out there said, you know, I think Mother Nature's going to clean up this mess in about 10 years, and all the work we put into it with our handy wipes out on these rocks may change that by a few weeks. I wonder, when we get into the question of evaporation and biodegradation, there have been some pretty substantial claims made by Exxon, for example, that this oil spill is just disappearing by itself. Do you have any comments or any observations from your department's perspective about this whole issue?
Let me ask Larry to give me some help. I would certainly say that the oil spill is moving somewhere by itself, but I don't know that it's going away by itself. The figures that are used for both evaporation and biodegradation are based on characteristics of North Slope crude and basically a computer model to predict the behavior of that. And I might ask Larry to speak specifically to the rates that are being discussed here.
Yeah, the rates we've seen reported, the 70% rate for instance evaporation, yeah, and we would have some serious concerns about the size of that number. The contingency plan envisioned 65% recovery and a 35% loss by comparison. The total amount, we haven't seen a total amount reported to date for a couple of nights now. We will be requesting to get that total number again, but it's probably somewhere in around the 15 to 20% for amount recovery now. I haven't seen that for a few days, so that might be adjusted. Those are the relative ballparks here we're actually dealing with.
Are you talking about pure product? Or?
No, that is amount recovered. The percentage of that 15 or 20%, whatever it is, the amount recovered to date, how much of that is water, that would be another number that would have to be deducted from that.
Do you have any scientific evidence, or can you testify as to what evaporation and biodegradation we have seen of the oil slick?
The contingency plan, I believe the number in the contingency plan that was given for the amount that was anticipated to be lost to evaporation, I believe, is 15%. And, of course, that was prepared on the literature that was available, the North Slope crude. So at the time that the update in the contingency plan occurred in 87, that number, if it was accurate, reflected the best knowledge at that time.
There was some evidence from, I believe, a Dr. Payne who has studied the impact of North Slope crude oil spills, that when evaporation does occur, that some dangerous and toxic chemicals are then released into the water. Can you indicate to us what evidence there is at this point of any toxicity of the oil spill itself on waterfowl and fish life, marine life?
There are some, of course, substantial efforts underway in sampling water quality, subsurface water quality chemistry, some of the intertidal zones. Some of that information is coming in now. There are concentrations. There's a lot of data. There are levels. I don't think we have an overall grip yet on, you know, exactly what the impact is from a water quality chemistry standpoint, but there is a substantial effort going in that direction.
That study is underway?
Yes, there's quite a bit of work going on right now. That's part of the assessment work to determine the effects of the spill.
One of the things that we learned in visiting the Otter Rescue Station is that at least in two instances and perhaps more, there's been evidence that the sea otters have been blinded by their exposure to the oil. And we've heard of the same thing occurring with seals and sea lions. We've also heard some evidence that some autopsies performed on sea otters who were brought in covered with oil suggest damage to their lungs and liver. Have you heard of these same reports? Perhaps, Mr. Rue, perhaps this is in your jurisdiction.
Well, I'll try and answer, and I can have Lloyd Lowry tap me on the shoulder if I'm wrong, and then you'll have to swear him in. But yes, as I understand it, the both blinding is a concern, and we're looking into that. The sea otters did have problems with their internal organs, and in fact, that was the cause of death for a number of them. Would you like further amplification? I think you're accurate.
All right. If you think the testimony is accurate based on what I've asked you and your response, that'll be just fine. One last question on the sea otters before I surrender my time. It's my understanding that those sea otters which have been rescued, cleaned, and restored to health are supposedly going to be tagged and then returned to a safe portion of the environment where there is no oil slick. I also hear that there's some speculation that they will probably, if they perform as many of their species do, try to get back to their home areas, which may still be affected by the oil spill. Does this not argue for, perhaps if it does occur, does this not argue that releasing them at this time may just subject them to the same dangers all over again?
Mr. Durbin, this is an area, a specialized area that I do not know about, so if you would like, I'll have Lloyd Lowry come up and answer it, or I can provide an answer later.
Well, perhaps you can provide.
I'll provide an
not
answer.
Not that we don't want to swear you in, Mr. Lowry. We'll try to swear everybody in if we
I
can.
I don't know about the territoriality of Seattle.
All right.
So.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Durbin, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I might say one thing about biodegradation, and Larry, of course, would be the appropriate person to give you more detail if you want it, but biodegradation is a process that occurs basically when bacteria eat the oil. They metabolize it, and it doesn't happen in one gulp, but it takes some time. You have to have the right mix of bacteria and nutrients. It varies depending on what the temperature is, and it's a process that isn't fully understood, but it's also a process that takes a considerable amount of time, even under the best of conditions. The reason this is of particular interest to us is not only because we have a spill on the shoreline, in the water, and in the gravels now of this area, and it's continuing to hit other areas as the slick moves through Shelikof Strait further down the peninsula, but biodegradation is the treatment method that Alyeska Pipeline Service Company uses for ballast water treatment, and that is the basis by which they are seeking to continue to discharge ballast water after it goes through the ballast water treatment plant. So the effectiveness of biodegradation is a very great concern here. The components of the oil that are being released through the ballast water treatment plant are the most toxic portions, benzene, toluene, xylene, and in doing that, we want to make sure that that effluent is fully treated by biological methods or whatever methods. So we're following this very closely, and we don't have tremendous, yes, biodegradation eventually happens, but it's hardly the method of choice when you have the heavy oiling, the impacts in the intertidal zone, and up on the beaches that you have here.
Thank you very much. Is the state, has Alyeska complied, or what's the status of the emergency order that we discussed earlier?
There were different parts of the order to go into effect at in different times. It's my understanding that the equipment that we required to have available is available, except for those things which had a longer schedule for them. For example, some of the boats are going to take longer to bring online. But as far as the immediate response equipment, we believe that's present. We've done an inspection at Alyeska to verify how much equipment was there prior to the orders being issued, the amended order being issued. And we are satisfied that the specific steps are being brought online on the schedule we envision.
That emergency order remains in effect how long?
We will be, the emergency order will remain in effect until we complete the review of the contingency plan, and we notified Alyeska at the same time we issued the original emergency order, my signature, that we were going to be reviewing the full contingency plan and expecting modifications. So what you see with the modified emergency order is just the first step. It is not all of the provisions that we expect to require, and we are also asking the Coast Guard, and we'll be requesting this within a day or two, to revise the aids to navigation and certain other steps necessary to maintain control over tanker traffic within.
So this process that you just went through with respect to the contingency plan, what was it, last year?
It was completed in 87.
87, you will go back through now?
Well, we're going to approach it differently, but we will examine every part of that plan.
Thank you, Mr. Owens.
Commissioner, you referenced earlier on, I think, the Alyeska's reticence at responding to the scenario of 200,000 barrel spill. I think this took place a couple of years ago, 2.5 years ago. And they wrote your department and said that, in their judgment, a 200,000 barrel spill would occur only once every 241 years. Is it your feeling that we can relax now, or for at least for 240 years, or do you think that we need to worry, as I gather your testimony indicates, and ought to consider changing how we require that these spills, even if they don't occur for 241 more years, ought to be prepared for?
Mr. Owens, I think that it is essential to prepare for a possible spill. It's critical, of course, that prevention be the first step. And let's bear in mind that this is a tanker spill. This is not a routine spill from the terminal. And I put the word routine in quotes because I don't think any spill should be viewed as routine. But I think the number 241, of course, is it's just imaginary. That's a way of trying to suggest that the danger is so remote as not to be taken seriously. And I think it's clear that we have to take it seriously. The risk is not only to places like Prince William Sound, but anywhere that this kind of activity occurs, the same risk is posed, and we should be prepared for it not only here in Alaska, but wherever the risk could result in someone else's beaches, someone else's fisheries, someone else's communities being put at risk.
You obviously, from your testimony, have some strong feelings about changes that ought to be in the law, and I would like to request that you provide the committee with your suggestions, specific suggestions, on how we further approach it. One last question based on your observations. Who's making the decisions on cleaning up the beaches, the priorities of where the assets are deployed? Where is the chain of command? Is that clear?
I think the chain is clear. The way it is being done now is, or the way it is being done, is that we have mapped the areas of shoreline that have been impacted, as the information is now known. We've also mapped with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, of course, being the key consultants here, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, where the critical habitat areas are. When we put them in the computer, we can overlay those and identify those places that need attention first in order to reduce the likelihood that the fish or wildlife will be damaged. We participate in the shoreline group, the shoreline committee, which identifies areas of work and sets out what conditions should apply there. The shoreline committee does not slow the work that's being done. There's a backlog of approved areas that are ready to go for Exxon to do the work that they've promised. But we're handling it that way. We get out ahead of the process by working with our colleagues in the Department of Fish and Game. We've pre-cleared beaches, so they'll be ready to go when the Shoreline Committee is ready to take them up. Shoreline Committee takes them up, forwards them to Exxon. Exxon has not caught up with us yet.
What's the role of the Coast Guard in all this?
I left out the one point, and that is that the one point of
defense, you know.
That's right. The one point of contact for this is the on-scene coordinator, and that's Admiral Robbins. So when I say we pass it on to Exxon, it is directly through Admiral Robbins. And of course, his directive to all of us has been that time is of the essence here. We want to make sure that when Exxon is ready to move into another area or to return to an area that needs further work, that we've done our homework and they can proceed with the appropriate safeguards.
Your recommendation that the law be changed to provide for clear responsibility on the part of the federal government to direct this cleanup, all without, of course, letting responsible parties off from their liability?
Not necessarily. I think that you would have to look at which entity can be most effective. And in this instance, the state and local communities, local governments may have the ability to be better positioned for an initial response than would the Coast Guard. It depends on the area. But the part of what you suggest that I think does require support from us at this point is that none of the government agencies involved, and by that I mean the Coast Guard or the state or the local communities, should have to wait until the cleanup has gone awry before we can take action. And under current law, both state and federal, the responsible party, either the initial responder, such as Alyeska, or as Larry Dietrich described, a responsible party who subsequently comes in and assumes the responsibility for the cleanup. Under current law, both state and federal, the ability to do that first rests with the spiller. And if that spiller does an adequate job or kind of keeps the ball in the air, neither the state nor the Coast Guard is really in a position to step in. Is that the best way to protect our people and resources? I don't think so. I think there needs to be a different mix. And as you suggest, as your question implies, one way of doing that is to make it so the Coast Guard, the state, local authorities can move without having to wait for something to get totally botched up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I'd just like to return to the line of questioning that Congressman Durbin was pursuing on this evaporation, because I'm a bit confused here. The 1977 oil spill contingency plan, page 3-56, says 50% will be recovered at sea directly after the spill, later time being washed off the rocks, containers skimmed. 15% will evaporate, 15% will be recovered from the shore, primarily from washing oil off the rocks. I'm not certain how that's different than the first 50%, which will be recovered from the shore. 15% will naturally disperse. I guess that's the microbial action that you're discussing. And 5% will remain in the environment. Are you aware of any unusual conditions that prevail at this time, or any is this an unusual batch of oil? Anything that would lead us to believe that 35 to 40% of it has evaporated, and I mean, is there anything that would lead your agency to that conclusion? Because Exxon told us, as I recall, Mr. Durbin takes better notes than I do, but I think it was 35%. Was it that they?
General Yield, I think their statement to us was that 40 to 50% of the oil within 1 year would evaporate, disperse, or biodegrade.
Okay. But at this point, and in their ongoing summary of where the oil is now, I recall quite high numbers, and I'll have an opportunity to ask them later on the evaporation. Could you just address that? I mean, my understanding is it hasn't been particularly warm, not in my observation. Anyway, I'm from Oregon. I'm used to rain, but this is February for us.
I'd ask Larry to join me in the response, but I don't know of any unusual circumstances, except that it has been clear and sunny for what is sort of an unnaturally long period here in the Sound. One thing I would like to flag for you, though, is it's awfully easy to talk about dispersion of oil, but I'm not sure what that means. Does that mean it's just out of sight while it still has the potential for causing damage? For example, one of the things that fishermen and other local observers have said to us repeatedly, and these are folks who are pretty careful watchers of the Sound and the Gulf, they've said, look, you may not see the oil, but I've hauled up an anchor line from what apparently is clean water, and it's been coated with oil. We've had observations from the air suggesting that some of the oil may be below the surface, having achieved neutral buoyancy, and it be brought down below the surface for one reason or another. So this whole idea of dispersion and what that really means and where that oil really goes and what effect it has when it goes there, I think deserves some additional scrutiny.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Questioning from last we heard from Representative
Thank you very
Peter
much
DeFazio
for
of Oregon
for your testimony and for your help. Appreciate it.
That was Chairman Miller thanking this panel of state witnesses led by Commissioner of BEC, Dennis Kelso.
The next panel
Frank
will
Rube,
be made up of Ken Adams, the Cordova District Fishermen's United from Cordova, Alaska, Jack Lamb, Cordova District Fishermen's United from Cordova, Alaska, and Dr. Federica Ott, Cordova District Fishermen's United from Cordova. You'll come forward, please. We'll take your testimony in the order in which I called your names.
You're listening to live coverage of a congressional subcommittee hearing from the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom in Valdez, Alaska. Coming up next, a panel of folks from the Cordova District Fishermen United, or CDFU. We just heard from a panel of state officials. Still on the agenda for today, following CDFU, are representatives of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company. The members of the CDFU panel are seating themselves, and they're about to be administered the oath.
And let me again say it is the practice of the subcommittee to swear all witnesses who appear before it at investigative hearings. Do you have any objections to being sworn? If not, if you'll please rise and raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear to affirm that the testimony that you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? In order to
inform you of your rights as a witness before the committee and the limitations on the authority of the subcommittee. The rules of the House of Representatives and the committee are on the table in front of you. Both sets of the rules have previously been provided to you. You are advised of your right to counsel. The role of counsel would be to advise you of your constitutional rights. Do you desire to be represented by counsel? Thank you. Mr. Adams, we'll start with you. I don't know that they can hear you. You're going to have to... So have you speak into the mic and see if it's on here. No, we don't have a mic here.
We're experiencing a slight problem with the House PA system. Someone from the staff here at the Civic Center is rushing over to make an adjustment. Just a reminder, this coverage is brought to you by KCHE Radio and by the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is also through the facilities of Alascom. This is coverage of a committee hearing by the House Subcommittee on Water Power and Offshore Energy Resources, chaired by Representative George Miller of California.
Yeah, Kenneth Adams is my name. I'm the SANE Division Chairman from Cordova District Fishermen United, CDFU, a member of the of PISWAC, that's the Prince William Sound Agriculture Corporation, executive board member of that association, a salmon SANE permit holder, and a herring pound permit holder in Prince William Sound, and I also teach marine biology at the Prince William Sound Community College in Cordova. I'd like to address my comments to you gentlemen in three different groups. One would be mostly introductory concerning the fisheries of Prince William Sound, and then what some of the short-term effects are and long-term effects are that we can expect. That is, effects upon our fisheries. The Prince William Sound region comprises both Prince William Sound itself and also the Copper River and Bering River districts. The most important species, most important commercially to us, are salmon,